Hi, this is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence, and it's actually part two of an interview I did last week with Thomas Frank, the author of a new book on populism in America, The People Know, basically on smashing the populist tradition, which came into its own in the 1890s, a great movement that swept mostly the Midwest, but elsewhere in the country, really origins in Kansas, which, after all, Thomas Frank is very well known for his book about the change in Kansas in the Midwest in America. But it was about the farmer labor struggles against big power, monopoly power, and how that movement, which swept into the South, which had a lot to do with segregation as an answer to it, was smashed by corporate power using all the new gimmicks of public relations, advertising, of course, wealth, to destroy one of America, maybe America's most profound democratic exercise in establishing the power of common people. And it had a lot to do with the failure of the wealthy class to deliver on the promise of the American Constitution that they would share the wealth to some degree, that we would have a new middle class. And then we had the Great Depression, and populism came back into its own in the era of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the rise of industrial trade union movement, which said, no, we have to be cut in. We have to have political power, or because you people don't care about ordinary folks. And that movement, which has been celebrated and is a great Democratic Party victory because of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, but he did it under pressure from the trade unions, including those that organized black workers, minorities, people of color, and from different immigrant backgrounds. And that movement basically has been smashed in modern history. Populism was given a bad name. Franklin Delano Roosevelt's programs in the New Deal have been in very basic ways reversed with Bill Clinton and others in the Democratic Party over the years. And the second part of this discussion is a very important discussion about the Democratic Party's selling out this populist tradition and basically betraying Franklin Delano Roosevelt. We're talking about class consciousness. We're talking about how a ruling elite, a capitalist elite, maintains power. And at first, the response of this capitalist elite to the populist message, was to just smash it as alien, as bad, blah, blah, blah. Okay. And they failed. They failed electorally, as you pointed out, and so forth, in certain places. And then they adopted, particularly around Roosevelt, they adopted a new strategy, right?
Yeah.
Because you pointed
out to everybody now, the populists, yes.
Yeah, but you now point out that, and actually you established that Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the New Deal was attacked viciously by the elite, including the academic elite, including the major newspapers. And that's a very important thing, because the Democratic Party would like to say, well, we've always been on the side of workers, we've always been on the side of people of color and of women and so forth. But the fact is, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was, and certainly a lot of credit, I don't think your book gives enough credit to Eleanor Roosevelt, but I think she certainly was instrumental in that, but mainly because he needed labor.
Yeah,
he needed that organized power. And he was derided and by professional economists and professional thinkers and the university and the leading newspapers. My God, you quote, I worked for the LA Times for 20 years.
Yes.
Your quotes from the LA Times show it to be a despicable rag of the ruling class.
Oh my God. Bob, and I just scratched the surface there. You know that. I could have filled chapter after chapter with that stuff.
No, it was an deliberately anti-labor paper, and not just because they got bombed at one point, but and the New York Times was just vicious, and by the way, which also supported Clinton on the deregulation of Wall Street quite vociferously. But back in the 30s, everybody forgets this bit of history. Yes, this was the heyday, I think, of the Democratic Party, but not of the elite not of the establishment, not of people of wealth. And then in your book, you bring up an idea which, since I teach communications theory and everything, is very important that I had overlooked, that when the strategy of a frontal attack on Roosevelt failed, and after all, Roosevelt won 4 elections, the big industry, under the influence of PR, advertising, and everything, decided, you know, basically, let's co-opt their language.
Yep.
And you bring up the case of DuPont, a much reviled company and a horrible employer and everything. But now let's make this as American as apple pie again. And let's use language and manipulation coming out of the war to make it sound, you know, they co-opted.
Yes,
the whole progressive,
that's exactly right.
Language.
Yes, they did. And this went on. This is, you know, another subject I've written about at great length, is the way these corporations then began to present themselves as your best buddy, you know, your friend. They're right with you there in the patriotic struggle and the voice of the people, and they could out populist anybody. And that's really the tradition that someone like Donald Trump or Ronald Reagan comes out of. You know, Ronald Reagan sort of learned all his tricks at General Electric. He learned this kind of fake populism from these guys.
Let me give you a little footnote on that, because I actually talked to Ronald Reagan. I interviewed him before he was governor of California, and I interviewed him when he was running for president. And I got to know him quite well and spent a lot of time. And what you are referring to, in case listeners don't know because they don't remember, he became a spokesperson for General Electric. But he had come out of, as he talks about in his own writing, and I talked to him about it, he did not disrespect the New Deal, and he was raised in a home where, as I say, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was revered, as I was. And Ronald Reagan, what happened was, when he became the spokesperson for General Electric, they took him around to every plant. And Ronald Reagan, after all, had been head of the Screen Actors Guild, and he claimed to be on the side of labor unions. His beef was not with labor unions originally. And he would talk to people. And in these GE plants, they would tell Ronald Reagan, no, we have a great health system, we have great working conditions, and we have a very strong union. It was the United Electrical Workers, originally a progressive union that got red-baited out of existence by McCarthyism, and then the International United Electric Workers took over, but they were also a pretty good union. And so Ronald Reagan, when he was celebrating GE, was celebrating what used to be considered an enlightened capitalist company that paid good wages for American workers. But when Ronald Reagan was president, and you had the savings and loans scandal,
yeah,
by the end of his presidency, he became disenchanted with the idea that just big business would always do the right thing. And what happened with the General Electric, they ended up getting into banking. GE Capital became, the major source of income. They got involved very much in the housing scams.
Yes.
And all that. And 2 out of 3 jobs, by the time the housing crisis came along, they had shifted abroad. They were not this great American employer company. So I don't want to defend Reagan excessively, but the fact of the matter is, he wasn't able to pull off the major deregulation of Wall Street. That remained for Bill Clinton,
exactly,
who united,
exactly,
with the Republicans in Congress to do what maybe Reagan fantasized. But I must say that in terms of his experience with GE, because I did quiz him quite extensively on all that, you know, he was talking about a different GE than the one that participated in the housing meltdown and that has sent all those jobs abroad, which, were, by the way, was so close to not only Clinton, but to the Obama administration.
Yeah, I guess what I was getting at is this kind of pseudo-populism that these people do. And Reagan was very good at it, making people think he was, he was their friend. He was on their side. He was all about, helping them be against snobbery and against the elites. And this all comes out of the Roosevelt days, when, you know, the upper class attack on Roosevelt in 1936 so completely and utterly fails, And everybody realizes that if they're ever going to rebuild conservatism, they're going to have to do it in this completely different way. And so fast forward to a few years ago, you have Donald Trump speaking at the Republican convention. And I heard this with my own ears and saw it with my own eyes. And he gave a shout out to the forgotten man. I love it. It's like right out of Roosevelt. I mean, they're still doing this. They're still stealing lines from Franklin Roosevelt. Meanwhile, the Democratic Party has decided, they sort of changed positions. The Democratic Party decided that it wants to be, you know, the party of making people respect science and respect authority and respect credentialed, you know, expertise. You know, and the other thing you raised that I didn't get to is the civil rights movement, which is the last sort of heroic part of the book. And there have been very few really great populist heroes since those days, since the 1960s. But Martin Luther King is actually a much more interesting guy than the modern day image of him, where he's only about getting the civil rights movement going and that sort of thing. He was actually, had a lot to do with organized labor, spoke at union gatherings all the time, was understood what he was doing as being part of this long tradition of helping working class people. It wasn't a class neutral program, what he was doing. And in fact, towards the end of his life, he and Bayard Rustin and some others came up with this plan that they called the Freedom Budget. And it was basically reviving one of Roosevelt's old ideas of a second Bill of Rights. The idea was for a massive expansion of the New Deal or of Johnson's Great Society, and to make good housing available to everyone, make a good education available to everyone, and of course, make healthcare available to everyone. They had it all figured out. It could have been done. And then unfortunately, he was murdered. The Vietnam War interceded and sort of sucked all the air out of the room. And you know what happened next. And we basically we've never been able to get back to that moment.
Well, let me talk about that moment just for one second, and then we'll wrap this up. But I have one last question aside from this. But, you know, the fact is, under a Democratic administration, and I'm just trying to be objective here, under Lyndon Johnson, the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover's FBI, engineered a scheme to get Martin Luther King to commit suicide, to destroy him. Yep. And they smeared him. They under surveillance, if they had the modern means of surveillance, they would have succeeded. But even with the primitive means of listening to conversations through hotel rooms and tapping the old-fashioned phone and everything, they set out to destroy him. And they wrote a letter, Deke DeLoach and Sullivan in the FBI, the number two and three guys under Hoover. Very deliberate, calculated plan to get King to kill himself and to alienate people from King, and concocting evidence and smearing him in the most vicious way. And this was all why were they doing that? Because they claimed that King had leftists and communists around him who would come out of the history you're describing, and that they claimed that he was not just a civil rights person, but that he was really interested in the betterment of working people. That was really the argument, that he was actually a leftist, and what they were using against him was the fact that he was doing the Poor People's Campaign. And in your book, you have a poignant description of the tent city that Martin Luther King wanted to set up in Washington, more than going far beyond the March on Washington, demanding proper working conditions, demanding economic change. And really, Martin Luther King was, in the way you define it in your book, a populist. And he understood, he anticipated the Black Lives Matter moment we've had in the middle of this pandemic. That in fact, you can put things down on paper about civil rights, but if you don't have a reality in the workplace, in the living conditions, in the educational system, all the things the populists would have talked about, did talk about 100 years before, Martin Luther King understood very well that it wasn't going to work. And that's why we have a Black Lives Matter movement raising issues that you would have thought would have been resolved a long time ago.
Yep. That's you're exactly right. And so by the time that King was on the national stage, it was unusual for people to call themselves populists. But I'm going to tell you one last sort of ironic story. There's so many ironic stories in this book, but
hey, given that you've been blocked out of media elsewhere, why not take advantage?
Yeah, let's do it. So yeah, King, yeah. one of his sort of great moments, one of his great oratorical moments is when he's giving a speech on the steps of the Alabama Capitol building. It's at the very end of his Selma to Montgomery march in 1965. And it's a great triumphant moment. Congress has just passed the Voting Rights Act, which is, you know, the triumphant thing. So that, you know, because the South, ever since populism, the South has been denying, oh, we didn't tell that story. So to put populism down permanently, a lot of these Southern states disenfranchised Black people and disenfranchised a whole lot of poor whites to make sure that something like populism could never happen again. And anyhow, so King is standing on the steps of the Montgomery.
But by the way, let me just interrupt you for a minute, because again, it's something I learned from your book. You raised the question, where did segregation in its sort of legal formation come from?
Yeah, that's what King was asking that day. That's what his speech was about.
Yeah, well, I just want to set that for people listening to this, because we just assume that somehow the South had slavery and then it had segregation. But segregation as a structured legal system and refined legal system really came in response to this threat of populism, of uniting white and Black workers in the South who were living in conditions of misery. If you could have gotten them united and they would have thrown the leadership of what was still was then the Democratic Party, that would have changed the politics of the whole country.
Oh my goodness. It would have been massive. If populism had succeeded, it would have been extraordinary. Yeah. But
let's set the stage, because people don't have that much of a sense of history.
Yeah. So it's funny that this has never been a well-known chapter of American history. And I mean, we're in this period now where we are, we are smashing icons and we're overturning past heroes, but there's still very little curiosity among the mass media about where this system came from. Where did Jim Crow come from? Because like you said, they didn't just do it right after the Civil War. It took a while to set this system up. Where did it come from? When did they decide to disenfranchise Black voters? How did they go about it? Et cetera, et cetera. And when you dig into it, a lot of it happened in a lot of places as a response to populism, as a way of making sure that a radical threat like this could never happen again. And Martin Luther King actually knew this history. The reason he knew it, it's not, you know, hard to figure out. There was a famous historian of the South back in those days. His name was C. Van Woodward, who wrote about this. He wrote book after book after book about this story. C. Van Woodward was a classic Southern liberal. And for him, populism was the only bright spot in Southern history between the end of the Civil War, or I should say the end of Reconstruction, and then the present day in the 1960s when he was writing. Populism was the only moment when there was even a glimmer of hope that that Blacks and whites could get together in some kind of common action. And Martin Luther King knew this history pretty well. And so he's at this triumphant moment in Montgomery, Alabama, and he's giving this speech, and he does this amazing shout out to the populist movement of the 1890s. And he talks about how it threatened the Bourbon Democrats of the South and how they instituted Jim Crow as a response to populism, so that to reinforce this idea of white solidarity, so that they could go to the poor white farmer who had nothing, you know, who was basically starving almost, and say to this guy, well, you know, at least you're a white person, so you're better than these other people. And it's one of King's great moments. You can watch the speech on YouTube, but he says, anyhow, I don't want to spoil it, but you should go and watch the speech because it's absolutely fantastic. And he says, you know, the poor white farmer, when his stomach growled and, you know, called out, you know, his family called out for food, he ate Jim Crow, a psychological bird that told him that no matter how bad off he was still better than these other people. It's one of his beautiful moments, but here's the ironic message. So King is giving this speech in Montgomery, Alabama. This is a few days or whatever it is, a week after his his friends have been beaten bloody on the bridge at Selma by the Alabama state troopers. King's arch rival is a man called George Wallace, who is the governor of Alabama, who sent those state troopers to beat up those protesters, and who is sitting on the governor's chair at the very moment that King is giving this speech and giving this shout out to populism. Okay, that's 1965. In 1968, King gets murdered, and George Wallace decides to run for president. And the National Press Corps is horrified by Wallace. He's this sort of proto-Trumpian figure. He goes around the country, you know, he's arch-segregationist going around the country, pretending that he cares about ordinary working-class people and this kind of thing. What's the word that the press corps uses? They decide that they're going to use this word to describe George Wallace. It's populist. This is the word that they apply to George Wallace. And ever since then, we have decided, we've determined that, you know, people who mine this same vein, this kind of resentful pseudo workerist anti-elitism with a you know, heavy overtones of bigotry, that's what they are, is populists. It's a fantastic irony. And it's an irony that's nevertheless... it's extremely toxic. It's been extremely poisonous for progressive, you know, mass movements of working class people. But it's been extremely flattering to a different demographic, to the kind of suburban liberals who, you know, with good educations, who think they know better. And this is the story of anti-populism in America. Anti-populism has gone from in the 1890s being the province of the most reactionary forces in America. And I go into this in some detail, as you know, Bob. There's a, if you go on my website, tcfrank.com, I've got a whole lot of their political cartoons and stuff. The anti-populists and how they despised ordinary Americans, ordinary working class Americans. This was a right-wing phenomenon to today, when it's a phenomenon of the highly educated liberal elite. And that's the... That's the whole story of this book. And I'm so sorry to say, Bob, that is the whole story of our time in this country.
Time for a break, and we'll be back in a few minutes. We're back with Sheer Intelligence and our guest.
Well, on that note, but let me say, the concluding chapter of your book is a Tom Paine-like statement. And it's one that's going to make a lot of people, the book is The People Know, I'm sorry, Metropolitan Press, please read it. It's 300 pages or so, but it's a fast read. It's accessible, well-documented, but it will make people uncomfortable. And what you basically talk about, it's interesting, you know, one area I have a very serious disagreement with you about. You're a younger person. I was quite active in the 60s, and I think you're a little bit harsh on the 60s left and so forth, and the Port Huron statement and people like Tom Hayden.
You might be right about that. I was not there.
I know. But, you know, and you're right, though, that it was limited in all sorts of ways. But the fact of the matter is, the people who went south in the civil rights movement, I personally was in the South in 1960 with some people who insisted on integrating bathrooms and so forth. But you know, and I was involved. But the people who, you know, did get involved and a lot of the people who did get involved in the civil rights movement and the connection, by the way, between the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement. I happen to have been the editor of Ramparts, where Martin Luther King first read the article that moved him to speak out at All Saints Church when he came out against the war. There was a lot more of energy coming from the 60s. So I don't want to get into that whole discussion. And there are other things I might take issue with in your book. But what I cannot dismiss, or not just dismiss, but I have to really say I got taken to school on this, I've been of the mind to excuse the elite. I wouldn't say excuse them, but at least assume that they're not in the driver's seat of the corruption of America, of the Democratic Party in particular. I never expected the Republican Party to be a center of enlightenment. But you really nail the cop-out. That's why I brought up the 60s. The whole 60s was about don't sell out.
Yeah.
Have some integrity. I remember I was there watching the FSM and participating at the free speech movement when Seymour Martin Lipset was standing next to me, actually. I was chatting with him, and he said, wow, this is of great concern. This is not a good thing, and so forth. So, you know, I was a graduate student. He was a big professor, but I did feel the need to take issue with him. But what you nail in this book in your conclusion, and let's end by talking about it, you present the elite as not just the handmaiden to corruption, servicing it, the court jesters, but you identify the elite produced by this meritocracy as the engine that's driving the current corruption, certainly of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, I think
that's a serious charge. And we're aware there's this meritocracy elite and so forth, and we're aware what it does, but you actually describe it as a menace to the democratic experiment. And I think that would be a good, and maybe that's why you're not being asked to be on all of these television and radio shows. You're calling out the people who are on MSNBC, are on PBS and NPR and so forth routinely.
Yeah.
And so let's end on that, because it's a serious question to raise.
And that is that liberals have become comfortable with plutocracy. And not just comfortable with it, we think it's correct.
It's the saving grace.
We think it's right, because the whole idea of meritocracy is that there is a hierarchy. There is a moral hierarchy. There's a hierarchy of learning. There's a hierarchy of goodness. And there's this sense now that you get from liberals. It's not, you know, we remember earlier in the conversation we were talking about all of these wealthy parts of America flipping. Did we talk about this? These wealthy parts of America flipping from Republican to Democratic, which happened in Orange County.
No, we could talk. It's not too late to talk about it.
Well, you know what happened in Orange County, and it happened in my just this year in the county that I grew up in, Johnson County, Kansas, which is the wealthy suburbs of Kansas City and highly educated. And when I wrote What's the Matter with Kansas, I thought of it as the most Republican place in America. And that was objectively true at the time. Well, they went for Biden this year. First time they've gone for a Democrat since Woodrow Wilson. That long. They were Republican and now they flipped. And you see this everywhere, that people are rich and highly educated together, is that they are flipping to the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party has very much become a vehicle of aristocracy, of plutocracy. And one of the reasons for that, there's a lot of different reasons for that. And you can look at Biden's fundraising. He dramatically outraised the billionaire Trump. He was supported by every important institution in American life, with the exception of big oil, every single one. And one of the reasons for that is because liberalism in its modern day incarnation is not only has moved away, has forgotten about its past as a working class movement, has a way of rationalizing.
Are you pounding the table?
No, that's my populist heating system from the 1930s the background. It's cold here in Washington. And I just turned the heating system on yesterday, and it has this kind of hammering noise that it makes as the boiler gets going. But liberalism provides a rationale for plutocracy. And it says, you know, we were talking about those yard signs earlier that mention all the liberal causes. And what liberalism does is it not only says, you know, we're not only richer than you, we're better than you. So you've got this ruling elite in this country that is largely defined nowadays by where they went to college and where they went to graduate school and what they studied and how well they did in school. That is really what defines the ruling elite of this country nowadays. You still have a sort of older elite here and there who inherited their money or who, you know, were entrepreneurs or whatever. But by and large, the elite of America today is this kind of white collar group that's defined by where they went to school. And this group looks out at the rest of the world and they say, you know, not only are we richer than you, but we're better than you. We're more moral than you. We understand politics better than you. We know the jargon. We understand the issues. And this is highly toxic that this sort of progressive tradition has now come together with and melded with extreme wealth and even provides a rationale for plutocracy. Now I am pounding the table. But I'm quite serious, Bob. That's where we are today. That is what liberalism does. That is one of the services that it provides to its constituents, is that it rationalizes their place in the hierarchy.
Well, but we can, you know, it's interesting because Chris Hedges has written, you know, attacking what he called the liberal class, and he grew up in it. You know, his father was a minister, but in a community where members, he went to some of their private schools and Harvard Divinity School and so forth. And he has shocked people by calling attention to this as really a serious menace in the society. And there's very little room. I've discovered this personally in my own household, my own circle of friends. You're somehow trapped in this middle between you got this menace of Trump and this, you know, straight out, defense of wealth and power. By the way, not the way he campaigned. I thought your book is really quite interesting on the faux populism of Bannon and Pat Buchanan that informed the Trump campaign at first and allowed him to wipe the floor of the Republican Party leadership. And even to this, day, I believe Kansas went 8% or something for Trump.
Oh yeah. He won the state handily. It was just that one county that I was.
Yeah. And so the irony here is that you have, on the one hand, you have Trump taking out half of the air in the room with a reinterpretation of the Republican Party that goes DuPont and those old corporations one up and says, we're on the side of the ordinary person who's being screwed by trade agreements and everything else. Yep. And then you have this liberal class that Hedges has written about so effectively that no longer stands for blue-collar workers, for working people, for ordinary people, be they school teachers, be whatever, you know, certainly not people working, for Apple and China or anywhere, you know. So where is the room? You're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. You know, the lesser evil and the greater evil aren't that far apart. And we're going to have a test of that now.
Yes, we are.
We'll, right. Yeah. And maybe that's a good point. So be kind of a guide for people to look now that Biden has won. Now they'll say, oh, but we don't control the Senate. You know, we have to even do more to get control. But that game has been played a long time of lesser evilism. Yeah. The fact is, what will they do about trade? What will they do about, you know, serious policy on immigration so you don't pit immigrants against workers, but you have, you know, a realistic quota of how many people, maybe a country like Mexico that has historic, after all, as Dolores Huerta points out, her family didn't cross the border crossed her family six generations ago. So maybe we need to have a legal quota for Mexico of 100,000, 200,000 a year, not the 25,000 that we used to have for Iceland and for Mexico at the same time. You know, maybe serious policies addressing trade so that maybe, okay, you want to ship jobs to China, you should have to pay a living wage in China, or at least not have the U.S. cooperate with the Chinese government in cracking down on labor unions and so forth. So there are things to be done.
Yes.
And basically the message of your book is they will only come from the bottom up. They will not come from the leadership.
Well, we're in a very difficult situation right now in this country. Trump has been defeated, but as you have mentioned, Trumpism remains strong. His base is still united. They're still with him. There's going to be another Trump in 4 years. This is just going to keep getting worse unless the Democratic Party finally takes steps. It's obvious to me what has to happen, that the Democratic, if they want to stop Trumpism, you know, they have to understand that it's their own movement towards this meritocratic elite that made Trump possible. They have to reverse that somehow. There's all sorts of obvious ways that they could go about reversing that. But I strongly doubt that they will. We're in a very dangerous situation. And I'm just, you know, it's going to be real interesting the next 4 years watching how this unfolds before the next Trump comes along.
So let me end with one little positive, well, not positive, but you're the only expert I know on, well, it's not true. I have some friends who grew up in Kansas and so forth, but when you say the Democratic Party enabled the rise of Trump, how could the Democratic Party legitimately win back, because they're not deplorables, how could they win back that population of Kansas that still voted overwhelmingly
for Trump?
After all, Kansas was where populism, Al Land and others, you know, came from, progressive ideas came from. That's the whole message of your famous writing, even now that you're being excluded, is that you understood something about the heartland of America. And how would you win back Kansas now?
Well, the first step is to actually listen to those people rather than just decide that they need to be punished. Which is overwhelmingly the attitude among the sort of liberal commentariat, you know, that these people are bad people, who there's something dark and wrong with their souls, and we should not offer them anything. That's obviously an enormous blunder. What you have to do is win some of those people back. The way you do it is, you know, you were talking about, by and large, working class people. This is the famous white working class, and my emphasis is on the working class side of that. And what's funny is watching all of these sort of liberals here in Washington, D.C. spin their wheels and say, well, what could a party of the left offer working class people? They can't even imagine. You know, it's like, dude, look at history. Parties of the left are supposed to be about working class people. It's incredibly easy to come up with things that a party of the left would do for working class people. For one thing, universal health care. For another thing, I mean, this one just seems like a no-brainer, make it easy for them to form labor unions again. Once you do that, it'll start to, you know, people start to think differently. They start to bargain. It changes people's attitudes about their whole life. I mean, I think of making school good and accessible and cheap again. You know, all of those things. You go right down the list of, you know, Martin Luther King and the Freedom Budget. You know, make sure that people have that housing is affordable. You know, these are all no-brainers, in my opinion, that the Democratic Party could do. Now, it's going to be difficult. It's going to be hard, but at least they can make a stand. A guy like Joe Biden is, at least he's not Hillary Clinton calling people deplorables. This is a guy that likes to speak to blue-collar audiences. You know, he likes to hang around in union halls and stuff like that. It's not that hard for him to make the case to these people. But he's got to understand the strategy of it and the long-term, you know, direction that his party has been going in if he wants to turn it around. And with that, Bob, you've drained me.
But you got to bite the hand that feeds you. And,
yes,
you know, he outraised Trump 2-1 in that home stretch by getting money from the fat cats, let's face it, yep. The very people the populace wonders about. Well, we've certainly done, now I don't want anybody to have the idea that we got the whole book, because this guy's a great writer, it's well documented, and I want to encourage people to get this book. It's really, I scratch my head and think, why haven't more of us written about this. Why were we so, maybe this was a big failing of the 60s left. Maybe you caught us there. Maybe we abandoned labor. Maybe we were elitist ourselves. You know, one of the charges of your book, maybe we were that baby boom generation also. I'm a little older than that, but, you know, maybe they sold out ultimately and abandoned working people in America.
Bill Clinton is the great political embodiment of that generation, and I don't think you can describe his career in any other way. You
know? Except there are a whole lot of people I run into as a journalist all over the years who are doing the right thing, working in schools, working, you know, all over. And why are they there? Because they were touched by the 60s. So let me just throw that in there, my own little editorial comment. I want to thank you, Thomas Frank. The book is The People Know, but it really is The People Yes, the old Carl Sandburg. It's called The People Know because it's about the people who are attacking the whole American history of populism, which is in the best sense as American as apple pie. I want to thank Christopher Ho at KCRW for putting these shows up. Thank Natasha Akimi Zapata for the introduction, Lucy Burbill for the transcription. I want to thank a shout out to Jean Stein, a great American writer and force. And she would have agreed, I think, with every word that Thomas Frank says in this book and has said today. And the JWK Foundation, which is keeping her memory alive, has given us some support for these shows. And that's it for this edition of Sheer Intelligence. Seeing you next week. Rien de rien. Non, je ne regrette rien. C'est payé.